This is Real Talk, the Customer Insights Show with Jen Vogel, a top-rated live stream and podcast in the market research and insights industry. We stream live on LinkedIn, Twitter, and YouTube, and you can listen on all major podcast channels. Join Jen and her guests for a weekly discussion around topics that will help you understand your customers better. Real Talk is presented to you by Vox PopMe, the leader in video research and ranked number one in qualitative research by Grit 2 years running. Here's today's conversation.
Hello, insights professionals, marketers, and everyone who wants to understand their customers better. I'm your host, Jen Vogel, and today we're talking about jobs to be done. This is a topic that's come up here and there on many previous episodes. It's a favorite approach of mine, so I'm excited to dive into that topic in a bit more depth today. I'm joined by Stephen Wunker, author of Jobs to be Done, a Roadmap for Customer-Centered Innovation, to get our questions about jobs to be done answered. Welcome to the show, Stephen.
Thanks, Jen, for having me on.
Really excited to have this conversation. It's, you know, we talk a lot about, obviously, this is the Customer Insights Show. We talk a lot about customer-centered innovation and research and insights. And so jobs to be done, such, you know, a topic that has come up a lot, but we haven't really focused on. So I'm thrilled to get your expertise on it today.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing. Clay Christensen, who's my mentor, came out with this concept back in 2003. And it's really taken about 15 years for it to get traction. And then there's just been this explosion of interest. So it's a wonderful thing to see. Unfortunately, Clay has passed away, but he would be so excited to see how much enthusiasm there is around this concept now.
Yeah, I mean, you're so right. It really has exploded over the last couple of years. And so, yeah, I hope he's watching over on this chat today. And so maybe to get us started, tell us a little bit about your career, your interest in jobs to be done, and how you got into this area.
Oh, you bet. So look, I started in consulting a really long time ago, back in the 90s, at one of the big blue chip consulting firms. And I saw how we could get it really right when we were working in conditions that were sort of stable, where you could do extrapolations and you had a pretty good sense of what the market dynamics were. And then we got it totally wrong when we had to make projections about things like flat screen TVs or ebooks, you name it. There were so many of these things coming out in the 90s that we were just totally wrong about. And I saw that the standard tool of market analysis worked really well where industries were stable and well understood. But when there was rapid flux or new industries, it didn't. And that bugged me as I went into the tech world, as he did in the late 90s, and I built and sold a couple of companies in mobile commerce, mobile marketing. I couldn't actually create the sort of traditional analysis that would be effective in those situations. After I sold the last company, I moved back to Boston, where I am today. And I linked up with Clayton Christensen, who was at Harvard Business School and had become a leading authority on innovation. Now, even though I had gone to HBS for my MBA, I'd never had Clay as a professor, and I'd never read his work, which once I finally did prior to my first meeting with him, I smacked myself on the forehead and I said, "You idiot, what Clay has been writing about would have saved me so much heartache over the past years." And so one of the concepts Clay had really first popularized was this idea of jobs to be done. And we can explain what that is in a moment. And it was a terrific way of understanding industries or markets that were in a rapid state of change. And so I worked with him to codify this not only into a theory, but into a practical methodology for how you can deploy something and really get a very rigorous assessment about not only where market is today, but where it is likely to be based upon those fundamental drivers of demand.
Yeah, that's such an important kind of distinction there about, you know, when you're in those stable conditions and you really have a good understanding of behavior and the market, then you can do really well. But as things are really changing and evolving rapidly, that's where some of these other techniques are really key to find success. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, you mentioned let's define what jobs to be done really is, or as Clay Christensen defined it, or as you define it in your work.
Sure. So very simply, it's about trying to make progress in a certain situation. You're showing the book there that I wrote. It was actually came out at the same time as Clay's book, Competing Against Luck, and that was orchestrated with him, that he sort of explained the overall theory and why this would be important. And this book that I wrote, Jobs to be Done, is about how you actually go deploy these methods. So let me give you an example to sort of make that specific. If I say that we're in the ice cream business, maybe you ice cream companies are competing on the basis of flavor or color or toppings or price. That's great, but it doesn't get to the fundamental drivers of demand, what people are trying to get done in a certain circumstances. So the last time I had an ice cream was actually this past weekend. I went out with my 11-year-old boy. We played mini golf, and there was an ice cream stand at the mini golf place. And I figured, even though it was actually right before dinner, it would be a good way to cap sort of an indulgent afternoon and have some very special time with him. So for me, ice cream was not just a sweet treat. It was a mechanism of bonding and signaling that we were sort of being the bad kids together, right? So those were the jobs that I was trying to get done. And the circumstance bore on that because I was with him. It was a social occasion. It would be very different if I was alone on a Tuesday night in the evening watching TV. Then my jobs to be done might be quite different in that circumstance. So that's what we mean by jobs to be done.
Yeah. So it really is that constant competition that we're in with ourselves about the features and the benefits, right? Like what actually are, you know, my favorite, one of my favorite quotes is the, oh my gosh, Seth Godin. Wow. I was like, if I forget that name on this show right now, how he talks about like people don't want a quarter inch drill bit. They want a quarter inch hole, right? Like what is actually, it's not the thing. It's not the flavor or the product itself. It's there's something driving the need for that. And that's always the positioning and messaging battle that we have, right? Of speaking to the benefit as opposed to the thing.
That's totally right. So, you know, Seth is actually taking that quote from Ted Levitt, who was a HBS professor back in the 60s.
Okay.
And he would say this to his classes. And, you know, what's remarkable is that this thinking is 60 years old, and yet it's so rarely found in common practice today. So, you know, then why is that? Why do we keep gravitating back to the functional requirements or the needs? And I think it's because that's easy to do. And, you know, there's not been, I think, until quite recently, a mechanism to have that broader jobs to be done thinking applied in a rigorous, systematic sort of way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. It is a lot easier. It's a lot easier to say the thing than it is to actually dig a little bit deeper. But, you know, how does the concept of jobs to be done differ from need states? Of consumers or of your customers?
That's a great question. It's one we get quite a bit. Mm-hmm. So let me use another example to sort of illustrate. So I'll go back to when I was in the big blue chip consulting firm. We were working with one of the big automakers on a refresh of one of their major vehicle platforms, the once every 4 years sort of major platform refresh. And so we went out and we figured, okay, let's find out what customers really want from this midsize sedan. And we fielded a survey of about 300 variables. And lesson number one is you do not field a survey with 300 variables. But leave that aside. We fielded a survey and it had factors like the turning radius and the headroom and the storage capacity. And we got the data and we were really excited about the needscape gap that we had identified. And we showed up in this big conference room and we presented the finding that the number one thing that people are really dissatisfied about and yearning for in a new car is brakes. And there was dead silence. Yeah, dead silence. And finally, this guy at the back of the room puts up his hand and said, hey, you guys are crazy. There is nobody who buys a car based on the brakes. If you want to name one thing that matters, it's paint. It's not brakes. Paint was way down our list and, you know, didn't agree at all with the data. But, of course, he was right and we were wrong. It's paint that sells cars. It's not brakes. So what we had done was we asked the wrong question in the wrong way. We had focused on very functional needs that people professed. And we had missed what actually drove dialogue in a dealership, which would be things around paint. Now, at the same time that we were making that mistake, BMW was out there researching for the launch of the Mini, which they had bought the rights to. It was a defunct brand, had been defunct for about 25 years. And they went out, not even revealing that they were a car company, but they wanted to understand what was important to their target customer, who was initially a woman in her 30s. And these people often said, I'm still fun. I may have two kids and three dogs and go to 15 soccer practices a week, but I am special and unique and individual, and I don't want to be just driving a gray minivan. I want something to express who I am. And so the Mini was able to claim that real estate and the mental real estate for people in the car industry. And they were able to charge a $5,000 premium to other small cars based upon fairly cheap modification to the overall body of the car with, you know, decals, basically, that they would do. And so they were getting at what a job to be done is, which was to have self-expression and individual uniqueness. Those were the underlying motivations that people had. And it came out in some feature needs, but things that would have never been expressed to us who were thinking about it in such a feature by feature, need state by need state manner. Now, jobs don't always have to be emotional. They can be very functional too, but you got to look broadly at what people are really trying to get done. When you do that, you'll find that you might be competing in Mini's case against fashion and special trips or maybe a unique piece of furniture. Okay, that's how the world really works. There's a lot of asymmetric competition that goes on because that's revealed by understanding those jobs.
You know, I know someone who bought a Mini for like exactly the reason that you described. So hearing you talk through that, you know, somebody who said, I always wanted a red BMW convertible and ended up buying a Mini after BMW. But one of the things you touched on like so briefly in your description, which I think is so important, is like when they did that research, they didn't even necessarily tell the people that they were a car company or that they were selling a car. And I think that's so critical because we can, when it comes to research or any type of consumer insight, focus on, you know, how do you feel about our brand or how do you feel about our product or would you buy this thing, as opposed to just understanding, like you said, you're going to compete against other methods for like meeting that emotional need that are not necessarily car related. So it's so important to understand what those things are, like separate, totally separate from what you're offering. There are still those surveys, maybe not 300 variables, but maybe 30 variables or something that you need to understand as step two or step three or a different stage in the innovation process. But that first step of just understanding the consumer or the group that you're interested in, just not related to your product, can really be helpful in figuring out how to solve that problem for them.
Totally. And, you know, by the way, that works in B2B markets as well. So we worked a while ago with a major bank overseas, and we were looking at their small business customers who they had gone out and they'd certainly surveyed many, many times. And people wanted a lower interest rate. They wanted a higher credit line. Okay. That wasn't news. They knew that. And so we went out, and before even saying that we were doing banking research, we went to these finance directors, so the heads of the small businesses, and you know, we tried to understand what was really important to them. And time and again, folks talked about unpredictability, that unpredictability is really the enemy of small business. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't a field that this bank was looking at all, but they actually had a lot of data and other assets that could help these small business owners and the finance heads deal with unpredictability. So it opened up a totally new vector along which they've since competed that they had just utterly ignored because they focus so narrowly. And we're a bank, we have to talk about banking products and the typical parameters of banking need states.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You know, there's so much opportunity to, you know, kind of like fit yourself the problem as opposed to trying to find the problems that, you know, that you specifically solve for, right? Like kind of expand the purview a little bit.
That's right. I start out when I do a book talk on jobs to be done, I'll often do a mock focus group about ice cream, actually. Mm. And it plays out the same way every time. It's remarkable. First, we're working for an ice cream company. We need to sell more ice cream. What will we do? And people always talk about the flavors and the toppings and the price and the promotion. That's great. And then you get them to tell the story about why did they have an ice cream? What were the specific last occasions and reasons why they had an ice cream? And importantly, if ice cream hadn't existed, what would they have done? And then you realize, yeah, ice cream is competing against wine or beer or a playground or a Disney movie. There's a lot of things that people actually use ice cream to do that they didn't think about when we put them in the shoes of the ice cream company. And these are folks who probably never even worked in the ice cream industry, right? But you just give people a little bit of framing and they put on those blinkers so quickly. So Jobs to be Done is a great way to take off the blinkers and really see the world as it is.
Yeah, I love that. This conversation is like, for some reason, over the last several weeks or months, like, been talking about a lot of these types of topics and, like, not focusing so much on the pain or the problem you're trying to solve or the specific function, but actually what are the alternatives and, how do you frame the question as opposed to like asking something like hypothetical, what would you do? How would you buy something like this? What would you consider? But tell me about the last time you did this right. And how much easier it is for people to answer in very specific terms of their experiences versus what they may or may not do in the future. Anyways, mm-hmm. This is like really resonating with some of those conversations I've been having recently with people. And I'm curious, we've talked about already kind of jobs to be done, need states, like features and functionality versus these kind of more emotional needs. Like what are some examples or scenarios where jobs to be done is really good to use in particular?
Sure. So there's a few. We've been talking about reframing markets, right? Finding those new vectors for differentiation that may not have existed before. That's a great way to use jobs to be done. You're trying to find some different way to compete. Maybe you're entering an industry or a market for the first time. Maybe you're already there, but it's gotten a little bit stagnant and you need to find some other variable to make it more of an asymmetric sort of game. So that's one. A second way might apply in B2B industries where you've got a lot of decision makers with very different motivations. And you need to find some common threads that you can compare these people to in an apples to apples sort of way, and then be able to pick which decision makers you're going to influence with what sort of levers, and probably which ones that you're going to give less attention to because you can't satisfy everybody. A third might be when you're trying to prioritize an innovation portfolio. And oftentimes these portfolios sort of take on a life of their own and people go after new sort of features or extensions. There's new lemon flavor, a new cherry flavor, but it doesn't really come back to fundamental drivers of demand. Mm-hmm. And so by understanding what those drivers of demand are and how your market really should be viewed, even if that's not traditionally how you viewed it, and how market research reports might not have traditionally taken that lens of, then you can prioritize based on where the growth potential really lies and where you have competitive differentiation. And then one last one might be when you're trying to stretch a brand. And there are certain characteristics of that brand that you need to stay true to. But there's also very different jobs that brand might be very well suited to address, but haven't. We talk about Colgate, for instance, going into the freshening up on the go market with items like the Colgate Wisp. So Colgate has not traditionally been associated with freshening up on the go, but there were ways to link that through to equities that it did have that enabled it to create a $100 million category that basically had not existed the past year. So a lot of different applications, but really it comes down to where are you trying to find those novel ways to reframe a market and pick out what are the particular levers that have been under-addressed in the market to date, because it hasn't been traditionally defined that way.
Yeah, we talk to a lot of people on here or with our customers or just in the market about, you know, agile innovation. And so many companies are, that is, especially some of the bigger CPGs out there, that's the innovation strategy is, you know, the building these agile teams that are looking for, like you described, the, you know, that white space, that sort of stretch direction for the brand or for the product. Or, you know, we see these companies buying up kind of these very innovative small entrepreneurial companies that have found that space. So, I mean, there's got to be some pretty major differences in how companies are going about that discovery, whether you're that massive CPG and you've got all the resources behind you, but maybe some legacy processes versus those entrepreneurial kind of smaller companies that are emerging. I guess, what are some of the methods? Is it, you know, jobs to be done all on its own? Is it a combination of methods pulled together for discovery? What are some of the processes that you recommend?
Right. So some people who have come to Jobs to be Done for the first time are trying to find the job that some product helps a customer accomplish. And that is dead wrong. That is not the way you want to go at this, because oftentimes you get very company centric and you oversimplify the world. So, you know, for example, of what not to do, I remember a company that came to us in the diabetes market. And they said, well, we've determined the number one job of people with diabetes is to manage their blood sugar. Well, come on. I mean, that's, you know, that's a very convenient job for you to think that folks have. And it's, you know, highly oversimplistic, and it doesn't explain why people have the sugary sodas and doesn't give you any insight into how they live their lives day to day. So that is not what you do. What you need to do is find a handful of what we call North Star jobs that are at that high level of motivation and sort of don't have underlying reasons for them to exist. They just exist because, like, I want to, you know, feel individual and, you know, special, because that is a basic way that humans feel. Okay. In the case of the mini, right? And then you want to cascade that down into more granular sub jobs that link to very specific drivers, as we call them. So you're not only thinking about the jobs in isolation, you're thinking about what drives people to have a particular job in a particular circumstance. So that could be attitudinal, it could be about a short-term use case or occasion, or it could be a longer-term context. We use a tool called the Jobs Atlas to bring in the jobs with the drivers and then other variables, like the consumer journey and what really are the steps in that journey? What are the pain points? Where are the disconnects in that journey? We look at the obstacles to getting jobs done successfully along that journey. Why do people sometimes drop out of the journey? What causes a lot of frustration? What triggers a next step in the journey or exploration of a new sort of solution? And then what's the value of getting a job done well? Then finally, we'll look at the competition, which will be your traditional competition, but it might also be totally asymmetric ways of getting that job done. So that Jobs Atlas unites 8 elements there to create a holistic view that jobs alone don't provide. Now, one of the interesting things about that construct is that is the exact opposite to how a lot of companies typically go about understanding a market. They start with competition, and then they look at the price points, and then they might look at very specific features that are in the products. And then they'll potentially look at the consumer journey that people take, and only rarely will they get to those fundamental drivers of demand. By rooting first in what really is the start of demand, is the start of why a customer is even in a market, you see the world as the customer does and not as the company does.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, interesting that companies do tend to kind of start looking at the competition first, and kind of work backwards and maybe never make it to those drivers? Or do you think they just assume like the drivers are there because competition exists?
I think that's right. But it's very easy to see the world as you want to see it, right? Mm-hmm. So you see it as the ice cream company and you compare yourself against other ice cream and maybe other sugary treats, but not against the playground, for instance, right? And that can be messy unless you have a very specific, rigorous way to lay out everything in an apples to apples fashion. And so because people fear the messiness of the world as a really exists, they simplify it. So even though Ted Levitt 60 years ago talked about the quarter inch hole and not the quarter inch drill, people still go back to the quarter inch drill because there are published market research reports on that and not on quarter inch holes.
Right. Because ultimately everybody's putting that hole in the wall for a different reason and needing to understand those top reasons or, you know, the why of the, you know, what picture you're putting in that frame to hang on that wall is a lot more complex. And, you know, there's something really dreamy about that, you know, very oversimplified world of there's one reason why people do this one thing and we've figured it out and here you go. Like, we'd love for the world to be that simple. But
not sure. All people with diabetes are just trying to manage their blood sugar and we can help them do that.
Right.
That's a very convenient and very wrong way to look at the world. But
right. Yeah,
that's what folks do. It takes a little bit of research. It doesn't have to be astronomically large, but it does take some research and you know, being willing to suspend some assumptions about how you think the marketplace actually works.
Interesting. So people that are sort of embarking on this, you know, trying to get to jobs to be done in the proper order. what are some mistakes that you've seen people run into with this approach? What should we watch out for?
Oh, there are so many. I've been doing this for 18 years now. Wow, I've seen a lot of mistakes that people make. But I'll give you a few. So they will think about jobs devoid of context, right? So managing blood sugar, all right, that's wonderful. But what if somebody is out at dinner with their friends? Is that their primary job? Or is it maybe I want to feel like I'm normal, even though I may not be? I don't want to feel like I'm sick, right? Or could that be the primary job in that context? So you need to really parse apart the different relevant contexts. Again, and that works in B2C. It works also in B2B environments. You might frame things in a very rational, functional manner. We've worked with a client that thinks they've got a great way to do jobs to be done. They just ask people exactly what they're looking to do and to measure that in a very specific sort of way. Minimize that, maximize this. And the thing is, they make air compressors, which have zero emotional content. And it's a very quantifiable, well-known sort of industry where you know exactly what you want an air compressor to do and when. But most of the world isn't like that. And so you need to be able to account for the messiness of reality, understand both functional and emotional jobs, and understand when people necessarily can't measure things, but they still have very important imperatives that they have, right? Yeah, I can't measure, feel like I'm a good dad, but maybe that's still a very important job to me. So we have to account for the reality and not what is just easy to measure. A third mistake is that jobs aren't organized in hierarchies. So you've got 85 different jobs about somebody undergoing some sort of process, which doesn't tell you at all where to start or what are the coherent themes or how do you create a digestible brand communication strategy. You just have these very disconnected things that you don't know exactly how to fulfill and how they fit together. There's conflict between jobs frequently. That's a fourth area. You know, breakthrough products usually don't succeed because they do everything better all at once for everyone. You have to make some choices. And you have to find those conflicts where you can create a new sort of resolution. So, you know, Starbucks, for example, manages to make people feel pampered while keeping service times relatively quick. Those used to be in conflict, and Starbucks created an operational model that resolved those conflicts. So it created a great innovation opportunity. Conflicts are between jobs are good. They point to innovation opportunity. Then a last one I'll mention is the questioning technique. So you don't just go out there with the survey of 300 variables or even asking people, so what are you trying to get done? What job are you trying to get done? Because, you know, that's like people landing from Mars, not talking human language. You have to go at it and get the real answer, which often means that you hold some of your whole research agenda a little bit close to your chest at first and reveal it only over time, like in the example we talked about with Mini. It also means you might go in sort of oblique questioning angles and triangulate what the jobs are and then try to validate that with the customer. But really try to get at the world as they see it and not in the convenient ways that you see it. So that might mean saying, well, you know, what was important to you today? What were your real priorities? What made it a good day or a bad day? Right, very high level, and then you sort of drill in on things that are particularly fruitful. But you go at it from a few different angles to try to get at the reality of how people perceive things and not just the easy way for them to answer, which might very well mean that you miss the real opportunity.
Yeah, I think that's important, starting really broad with the questioning and then getting more specific as you get closer to the, you know, the type of information that you're looking for. I love too what you said about, like, when you're talking about the conflicts, how sometimes jobs are in conflict with each other, and that this is a good thing, like an opportunity for innovation. I mean, this is what all the companies out there are searching for. What are those opportunities for innovation? So kind of looking to a jobs to be done framework to help identify that, that's exciting to me. Like, you know, find where those jobs are in conflict and solve those challenges, because people don't really know what to ask for. I don't know what to ask for. I don't know that I need, like, you know, some kind of, I don't know, a phone with games on it. I never would have asked anybody to make that for me, right? But somehow it adds to my life in a way that I didn't, that somebody doing jobs to be done research out there figured out before I did. And how important that is to, you know, kind of put things out into the world, into the market, that people say, oh my gosh, I never knew I needed this, right?
That's right. I had an example used with me once by a cleaning products company who said, look, the reason that cleaning wipes exist isn't because people want to spend four times the amount that they would normally for a paper towel and a little bit of spray, disinfectant spray, right? That's not the job to be done. So there are many ways that you can clean something. That's not the job to be done, but it's the fact that there are retentions. So I want to clean, but I don't know how much. I feel like I need to know where I've cleaned, and so there needs to be some wetness, and yet I don't want it to stay wet. I need it to sort of evaporate quickly. I am trying to use something as much as I can, but I also hate the feeling when something degrades in my hand and then I'm touching the cleaning solution. Right. And so you get these tensions that exist in the real world, not just with jobs, but all those jobs atlas components. And then you've got something to really work with. You define the sandbox much more precisely. And that leads to innovation.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. That's amazing. Now, how do you recommend kind of framing the outputs from this work in a way that registers with, like, I mean, I guess maybe even before I ask that, like, who in the business is doing this work to begin with, or should be? And then how are you kind of disseminating this so that everybody in the company is on the same page?
So the who depends a little bit by industry. So historically, it has been marketing, whether it's market research professionals or people who are responsible in the marketing department, you know, often a head of marketing. But that has grown, I'd say, in the past 5 years or so. We see more R&D people really adopting this methodology and using it at the front end of the funnel, even if the marketing requirements they've been given don't specifically mention jobs to be done. They want to understand the flow and the real ways that a product is going to be used in order to design it in the most effective way possible. And importantly, that means for them, not just adding in feature after feature after feature, but knowing what doesn't have to be there because it just confuses or adds expense. Product managers have also become a really important avenue for jobs to be done thinking. So that is typically in the tech world, and we've seen an explosion of these positions in the past 5 years or so. And there's a tremendous amount of interest in the product manager community about using jobs to be done.
Yeah, absolutely. We've seen that a lot too with product management, product marketing, any kind of R&D, like you said, these innovation teams really interested in that. Now we can go back to the question I was going to ask. And that just popped in my mind, but yeah, really how do I as a marketer or, you know, somebody as in product management then take what you've learned and kind of get it to frame it to register with executives or stakeholders in the business and make sure that everybody's kind of moving in the same direction.
Right. So there's a couple key lenses that we find are really useful. So first, you want to understand for particular types of customers, and again, this could be B2B, it could be B2C, what is an important job, and then how does that relate to these other Jobs Atlas components? So what makes it important or less important in a particular circumstance, for instance? What is the journey that this job is associated with? So you're not just looking at the steps of a journey, but you're trying to understand the why behind those journey steps, where it sometimes goes off track and what might trigger progress from one step to the next. And then you'll bring that on through to look at the success criteria for getting a step done well or not. What are the obstacles that get in the way, the triggers, as I mentioned, the value that's created there, the competitive sets. And by doing that, you're able to see things in context and really try to understand for that particular individual or set of customers, why is that job important and what are all the parameters around that that really matter? So that's one lens to see the job to be done in its appropriate context for a particular individual. And sometimes we'll often do a quant, but we'll go back to qualitative research and pull out somebody who is representative of this archetype so that they can see the real individual and how this sort of came to life. And then the second area we talked about is the tensions. So let's try to determine both what is success, but what it can't do, right? It's often not about minimizing this and maximizing this, but it's about balancing and trade-offs. So understanding in the appropriate context what trade-offs people are willing to make and where they have historically gone, you know, to a frustrated sort of trade-off. That enables you to excel where products haven't before, as well as to create those new vectors of innovation. But you do it in a very well-bounded, specific sort of manner. So Jobs Atlas and the tensions or trade-offs, together, those really create a lot of specificity for what you can do in an innovation situation.
Yeah, that's really helpful. I think too, framing it in a way that's like, not just here's the information, that's one thing, but this is what we need to do with it. This is the decisions we need to make around it. Tends to, like, you almost have to kind of understand the jobs of your colleagues be able to communicate in a way that speaks to that, right? Like speaks to the stakeholders in your business and what decisions they're trying to make, and being able to relate, like, hey, this is going to help you. This information I'm sharing with you is going to help you in this way to actually get them to do something with it.
You can use jobs to be done for internal functions as well. So totally agree. We did this once with a group of high potential leaders at a big pharma company. And the person who actually put up his hand first and said, I want to adopt jobs to be done was the general counsel. Traditionally not the ally of innovation, but he wanted to understand what people were really trying to get done and not just go do this kind of contract. Because he said there were a lot more efficient ways often to get things done than just focusing on the way it always has been done and the boxes that people typically put things in their mental models.
Yeah, I totally agree. That's so interesting. Yeah, the general counsel. Well, good. I mean, everybody can benefit, right? Now, do you have any, you've shared a lot of really great examples today, which I think really helps to bring this stuff to life. Any others, a recent example of a company that has done this particularly well?
Sure. So I'll name a couple companies because they've done presentations with us. So we've done work with Pods, for instance, the moving and storage company. They are not just selling a portable container. But they had struggled with really positioning what they're doing in ways that are going to register with consumers. And so they looked at what was important to people in a moving and storage situation, what their jobs to be done were. And then they associated that with some of the things that they could sell because of their unique model of bringing a container to your door. And then you have as much time as you want to fill it up or to empty it, or just to keep it on site if you want. And you could store it over there at the Pods facility too. So they came down to two jobs, which they now emphasize in their marketing, which are about confidence and control. Control over how quickly I need to move, or if I am moving to San Diego, but I don't quite know where, I can send my pod over there and have it stored and then just have it delivered at the house. And confidence that the movers aren't going to screw it up because I'm in charge. Mm-hmm. And then they were able to layer on top of that, some additional features to the product. So for instance, tracking of your pod as it moves across country so that you have some sense of control and confidence that, okay, it's in Pittsburgh now, it's on its way to San Diego. And so there are all these sorts of cues that mean that Pods is about confidence and control, both in the messaging and in the product. Very different industry, Tillamook, the cheese and ice cream yogurt company. They had really accentuated in the past their farmer cooperative ownership model. And it turned out that didn't really relate to the jobs that consumers were trying to get done. But a twist on that was talking about farm style. The farm style way they make their cheese, which their flagship cheese, is made exactly the same way now as when it was first originated back in 1909. And so talking about that and then bring that to other categories like the Oregon Marionberry ice cream, for instance, is also farm style. So these are flavors that you're not going to find from Nestle or Unilever, but they are from Tillamook because this is done in a sort of old-fashioned, slow farm style manner. And they could relate that sort of overarching brand message and equity in the brand to some core jobs that consumers were trying to get done, but were trying to accomplish in other ways, often outside the categories in which Tillamook was competing. So they were able to differentiate, and in a very mature market for cheese and ice cream, they have rapidly been growing share nationally because they've claimed this sort of unclaimed mental real estate catering to the jobs that people were trying to get done. You can also find this in a lot of business-to-business contexts, as I've mentioned. We have an extensive case study about how Twitter has used jobs to be done to position itself with advertisers and third-party developers using Twitter as a development platform. There's a lot of ways that you can deploy jobs to be done. Maybe it would help if I also gave sort of a context that maybe we could all relate to as well, because, this to me really spoke to the power of jobs. And so I'm speaking here in my personal capacity as a dad and not in my professional capacity running a consulting firm. So I had a kid, a boy, who wanted to have a big birthday party recently. And he wanted to do it around sports. And so he said, okay, I've got the idea. we're going to bring 10 of my friends to a New England Patriots game, which is really expensive. And I didn't want to sign up for a $3,000 birthday party. Mm-hmm. And so rather than just freaking out about that or trying to economize by taking him to, for instance, a preseason game, which would have been a little bit cheaper, I tried drilling into what was he really trying to get done. And he wanted to have a bonding experience with his friends. He wanted to be close to the action. He wanted to have something that was really exciting, and he wanted to have a whole bunch of people from his class. And so we went to a professional lacrosse game instead, where you can go right up to the field. You can meet the players. You've got a sense of the action. You've got the autograph of the lacrosse player, which you're certainly not going to get at a Patriots game. You can invite a whole lot of people, and still it's dramatically cheaper than a major NFL game. So by understanding the job, you can reframe your solution set. And by the way, it's not only about doing the newer, fancier, premiumized solution. Sometimes it allows you to do things cheaper because you understand what the customer is really trying to accomplish.
I love that example. That's so good. I'm lucky my son is still at an age where the high school team is the equivalent of the professional team. So we spend a lot of time at the high school games, but good tip on professional lacrosse being cheaper than NFL. We'll have to check that out as mine gets a little bit older. But all those examples are really great. Love that you mentioned the Tillamook example, since we at Vox Pop Me participated in some of that research a few years ago, specifically around the packaging for Farm Style. And I myself buy it because it's great. Like,
we converted.
Yes, I totally converted after that. And, you know, I think that they did a really great job with the communication, not just the positioning and the jobs, but actually how they rolled it out and how they did that rebrand. Like, really brilliant job there. And we did not plan that, I swear. But it is all of those are really great examples, and really helpful to hear you kind of talk through the structure and what to be looking out for and why this is important and why, you know, any company who's kind of starting at the other end in that competition area, maybe swing back around, start with those jobs and understanding the benefits that your product does or doesn't provide to your customers, and that's a smarter place to start. So I can't thank you enough. This has been such a great conversation.
Oh yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Fantastic. Well, thanks everybody for listening in. We are going to be back next week with another episode. We're speaking to Jacob Heiler at Ohio University and some of their marketing students. So looking forward to that chat very much. We will see you then.